This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It wasn't too long ago that Donald Trump was offering himself as a model of the successful businessman and sharing his secrets on the art of the deal. Now his empire has collapsed and he's become more a symbol of greed than success. The new book, Trump, The Deals and the Downfall, investigates how Trump really made his deals, how he co-opted politicians, used his mob connections, filed misleading financial statements, and relied on the help of his father, Fred Trump, a successful developer. My guest is the author, Wayne Barrett. He's been an investigative reporter for The Village Voice since 1978, which is also when he first started writing about Trump. So, after watching Trump's rise and fall, what's Barrett's angle?
I think one of the real themes of the book is that rather than this Horatio Alger figure that he was made out to be in the 80s, he's really a state capitalist whose wealth was really invented by the politicians that he compromised and that he co-opted over the long stretch of his career, whether it be here in New York or in New Jersey. He insinuated himself in New York development and in the casino industry, industries that were utterly dependent, really, on the decisions of politicians. And he managed really in episode after episode in this book to co-opt political leadership. He learned this really at his father's knee. The first political relationships that he manipulated were ones that he inherited from his father, Fred Trump, who was a longtime New York builder. And the then mayor, Abe Beame, and the then governor, Hugh Carey, were longtime associates of his father, and they backed his first project so strongly that he got the largest tax abatement ever granted in the history of the state to build the Grand Hyatt Hotel. It was then valued at $160 million over the course of 42 years. And the story that I detail, for example, and this is just one of many examples of the relationships that he had with politicians, is when he met with the Penn Central executives that owned the land that the Hyatt is now built on. They said he was boasting about his and his father's political connections with Mayor Beame, and they said, well, we want to meet the mayor. And Trump said, well, when? And they said, tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And without calling anyone, he said, my limo will pick you up, and we'll bring you down to City Hall at 2. And sure enough, his limo picked him up, went to City Hall at 2. Abe Beame greeted these Penn Central executives warmly, wrapped his arm around Fred Trump and Donald Trump, and said, anything they want, they get. Well, that's been the history of Trump development projects in New York.
I want to get back in a few minutes to some of the ways that he managed to get his political connections. First, a couple of other things I want to find out. What's left of Trump's fortunes now?
Well, he's basically been reduced to the three casinos in Atlantic City, all of which are in various forms of trouble. The West Side Yards project, which is his only real hope for a comeback, where he still hopes to develop that site along the waterfront, still the largest vacant parcel of land in Manhattan, and he hopes to develop it. And he still has Trump Tower and the Plaza Hotel. The Plaza Hotel is just can't meet its debt payments. But Trump Tower is a viable property. It is, of course, a condo building, so almost all the apartments are sold. But he has 17 floors of commercial and office space, which delivers him a rental income. He can sit back in Trump Tower probably for the rest of his life and be a small-time millionaire.
Now, Trump's book was called, his first book was called The Art of the Deal. Was he ever really a good deal maker?
He sure was. I mean, the initial deals of his life, for example, the Grand Hyatt, obviously I'm talking about, in terms of a deal maker, it was political guile more than anything else, but that's certainly an element in his deal making process.
And so it was political, not economic wizardry at work.
Right, but it was, the Trump Tower deal, for example, was just, I mean, parts of it, elements of it, were just good deal-making. How he assembled the site was an extraordinary, brilliant series of maneuvers. He managed to package an air rights package, a zoning package that was unprecedented in the history of the city, and he got it through the various elements of city review processes, the City Planning Commission, the then Board of Estimate. And again, he plied all those political relationships that he was developing, but nonetheless, it was clearly a brilliant deal.
He got a lot of backing from banks when he needed it. Do you think banks were overeager to finance his deals?
He went before the Casino Control Commission in New Jersey and boasted that the banks were literally dumping money in his lap. They were calling him and asking him to take loans for him. Certainly in the period of the late 80s, Citibank, for example, in a two-year stretch, loaned him $1 billion on four projects. They were all bad loans. All the projects were duds, over-leveraged, overpaid. And they were the Plaza, the Shuttle, which, of course, he had absolutely no airline experience. And they were not only loaning him, making a basic loan to him, they were actually doing second loans in which they gave him the equity that he was supposed to be contributing to the project just on his own personal guarantees. The major New York banks were doing this largely because there was such a demand in the foreign banking markets to get a piece of Donald Trump deals. The Japanese, the Germans, the French, the British, the Canadians all wanted pieces of Donald Trump deals. And for those slices of his deals, they were paying the major New York banks major syndication fees. So that the banks were not applying any of the normal risk-reward ratios to Donald Trump loans because they were essentially farming them out in such finite amounts to so many banks. That's why 75 banks had to be involved, eventually most of them foreign banks, in the restructuring of his loans in 1990.
Why were international banks, as well as American banks, so anxious to get a piece of Trump's deals?
Well, he was the golden boy. He was the icon of an era. They bought into the whole hype. Everybody, even the bankers, seemed to be getting his credit ratings from Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. He could go into a bank boardroom and come out and say to folks it was just like doing the Donahue Show. He just completely wowed them. Obviously, this was in part a result of the success of his early deals. It was also in part a result of Flim Flam. I mean, most of the major New York banks have regulations that forbid them to get involved in any casino financing. All of his casinos were financed through junk bonds. But what happened was they really didn't know anything about casinos. And the only real financial statements that he would give the New York banks were the financial statements from the casinos. And they just showed what seemed to the banks to be an endless supply of cash. So they said to themselves, well, look, Donald is going to be able to cover this. If he gets any problems in the Plaza or the Shuttle, he'll cover it from his casino revenues. Well, what they didn't realize was that there were all kinds of balloon payments due on the casino bonds. And what looked like projects or casinos that could generate cash cows forever really had very short runs to go before they couldn't meet their own debt payments. So that was part of the flim-flam. I point out specific instances where it was really more than flim-flam. It was bank manipulation. For example, Trump Palace, which is the condo building that he built, went into construction in 1989 on 3rd Avenue in New York when everybody else was bailing out of the market. He started to build. This was supposedly what Donald knew best, New York real estate. He wanted a $220 million mortgage from Citibank, and I have the memos that indicate that he had his own staff do workups on the price list repeatedly because he couldn't get a price list that would demonstrate to a bank that they could ever repay a $220 million mortgage. The first price lists only showed something like $180 million of possible revenue if they sold all the apartments at maximum price. So they kept going back and working over the price lists three times until they came up with a price list that exceeded $220 million. And that was what was used to justify the $220 million mortgage. And those are the kinds of numbers that were floated at the banks in financial statements that were used to deceive the banks. And at that time, they were even considering going public with some of the casinos, and they would have gone public with these hyped financial projections.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Wayne Barrett, and he's an investigative reporter for The Village Voice and author of a new book called Trump, The Deals and the Downfall. And he's been writing about Trump for many years. As you said before, you think that Trump really built his empire with his political connections. In your book, you investigate his connections to Mario Cuomo. And you say that Trump's penetration of Cuomo's inner circle is a textbook case in seduction. What did Trump do to seduce Cuomo and his organization?
Well, you have to remember that when Mario got elected in 1982, he was the anti-establishment candidate. Trump and all the rest of the major developers and real estate interests were backing Ed Koch, the mayor of New York, in that race. So they had Donald had to do a quick turnabout. And he and many other people were trying to figure out access to the Cuomo administration, the recluse up in Albany. And he tried every conceivable route. He hired the governor's son. He hired retained as an attorney, the person who was the chairperson of the Cuomo Campaign Finance Committee. He hired as a consultant the person that Cuomo installed as the head of the state Democratic Party. He hired the counsel to the state's Urban Development Corporation, which was the economic development agency of the state. He hired the law firm that employed the executive director of Cuomo's Campaign Finance Committee. He even hired the state police driver that had been driving Cuomo around for years and made him his bodyguard. All of these were attempts to ingratiate himself in the inner circle of the Cuomo administration. He also became Cuomo's largest corporate giver in the latter part of the 80s, was appointed to the advisory committee of Cuomo's campaign finance committee. And whenever asked about this constantly reappearing Cuomo presidential candidacy, this registered Republican and otherwise perceived as conservative businessman repeatedly endorsed Cuomo as a presidential prospect as well as a governor. In fact, the Republican Party tried in 1985 to get him to run against Cuomo in 1986. And when he turned it down, he made sure that the Cuomos knew that the head of the Republican Party had come and met with him and tried to get him to run against Cuomo.
What did Trump get out of the connection with Cuomo's inner circle?
Well, there's a series of things detailed in the book. For example, when Andrew Cuomo was retained by Trump, he was retained to draw up the commercial leases for a shopping mall that Trump planned on building in his West Side Yards project. That's where he planned to build the world's tallest building.
Let me interrupt you here. Yes. Andrew Cuomo is Mario Cuomo's son.
Yes, Andrew Cuomo is Mario Cuomo's son. And Andrew Cuomo was retained by Donald to prepare these commercial leases for the shopping mall. Well, the shopping mall was right beside the West Side Highway, and the State Department of Transportation approved the use of public funds to build a ramp directly off the West Side Highway that would lead directly into the shopping mall that Andrew Cuomo was preparing the leases for. Unfortunately, the federal government refused to approve it, really saw it as almost a private use of public funds.
Now, are you saying that the Cuomo administration has been particularly corrupt, or is this business as usual in New York politics?
Well, I wouldn't use the word corrupt. I haven't made any criminal allegation there. What I certainly think that this is unethical conduct. I certainly think that this is the kind of influence peddling. I say in the book that I believe Andrew Cuomo, who is now running a program for the homeless and has left his law firm and is leading a very different kind of life than he did in the mid-80s when these things occurred. But at that time, I think he was clearly involved in influence peddling.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Wayne Barrett, investigative reporter for The Village Voice and author of the new book, Trump, His Deals and the Downfall. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Wayne Barrett, author of a new investigation into the life and the deals and the influence of Donald Trump. Well, Wayne Barrett, I guess I just wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask you about Trump's relationship with Marla Maples now.
I do believe, and I think the book makes it quite clear, that his relationship with Marla is, to him, I think, is probably the most serious relationship of his life. I think he is much more involved with her than he ever was with his wife. The people that I interviewed that are very close to Donald told me that that he changed when he began seeing her in 1987. That they actually people who went, these are mostly women who had almost motherly feelings for him. And thought that he was kind of emotionally deprived, believed that he finally found someone that he could, you know, get outside of himself about. He's a very remote, isolated, lonely guy. I mean, for years, he and Ivana shared an apartment at Trump Tower but didn't share a bedroom. He would be calling people till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. just sitting there with the channel changer in his hand looking for a show about himself, stuffing a hamburger in his mouth. And that was his lifestyle. Very lonely guy. Marla kind of changed that. Now, they obviously have a tumultuous relationship with all kinds of ups and downs. The ring is back and forth. It's on. It's not on. It's, you know, but there's no question but that Donald finally found some reason to really befriend someone. He doesn't really have any serious male friends either. And as hard as I looked, I could not find anyone that people would really describe as a friend, the real intimate of Donald's. He's that closed off a person. He has publicly said that his older brother, Fred Trump Jr., who died at the age of 43 in the early 80s, died because he was too trusting a person. He was an open person and too trusting a person. So he said, "I trust no one."
Americans have really kept themselves entertained on Donald Trump's personal life. I wonder what your attitude toward investigating that part of his life has been.
Well, I tried to keep it to a minimum, but I had to do some of it. It's really a book about him as a businessman, which is most of his life anyway. I mean, there really isn't anything there but babes and business. If he liked to talk much more about the babes than he actually liked to do anything about it, too. I mean, Marla was a very different sort of relationship for him. So there's no question that the fascination with Donald, the reason why he became an icon of an age, much more so than Milken or Boesky or people who had far greater financial influence than him, was because of the way he looked. If he had been a ball developer, he would not have been the icon of the 80s. He was a great visual. He was a great soundbite. Trump Tower, the entrance of Trump Tower, was a great gold-plated visual. It was a combination of all these visuals. It was a man who melded with an age.
You started writing about him a long time ago. What first interested you in Donald Trump, and what was his reputation then?
I did a three-part series on him that I started in 1978 when he was a rookie and really just into construction with his very first project. He was already a glamorous rookie. Even though he hadn't achieved anything yet, there was a lot of interest in him, a lot of buzz about him. And it was the suggestion of my editor, Jack Newfield, at The Voice, that this guy's going to be big in this town, and Jack has an eye for that. And so I wound up spending 3 or 4 months on an investigative trail, and that trail led to this three-part series. I spent 15 hours. I did 15 hours of taped interviews with Donald. You know, took rides in the limo, got all kinds of the Trump charm, and it was kind of mixed with. At one point, he offered me an apartment, and the next thing you know, he was telling me about some reporter he had supposedly broken with legal suits, and it was a mixture of the carrot and the stick. And this was young kid Donald. In any event, the piece resulted in the impaneling of the only grand jury to ever investigate Donald. And so not surprisingly, he didn't talk to me again for another 8 years. He did start talking to me again in the late 80s. I thought he was going to talk to me for this book. He indicated he was through an intermediary when I was just beginning on the reporting trail. But then all of his problems hit in 1990, and I just don't think he could answer the tough questions from a reporter who'd been on the trail for months.
There's a growing disparity in Manhattan between the rich and the poor. A lot of the middle class just can't afford to live there anymore. Do you think that Trump's approach to developments helped add to that disparity?
Well, that's the great irony is that really his whole goal in life was to achieve more than the old man. And the old man built 20,000 units of housing for real people that real people still live in. Much of it is still good housing. And Donald has built about 1,000 kasbahs for oil sheiks, you know, offshore investors. You drive by Trump Park, which is right on Central Park, at night, and you don't see a light on in the building. It's black at night because it's all offshore corporations that bought the front apartments. The Japanese bought the most expensive apartments hanging over the park. Somebody might stay there a week or two out of the year. But that's hardly a social contribution. I mean, that's hardly a lasting impression on a town. it's hardly having done something that really has intrinsic merit.
Trump's publicist wanted you to change the title of your book. Your book is Trump, the Deals and the Downfall. The publicist suggested that you take out the word downfall because Trump is going to make a comeback. Do you think there's any chance of that?
On the eve of publication, Dan Clores, who was then his publicist, he goes through publicists he's no longer the publicist. He goes through publicists very quickly. But Dan Clores called me, and I don't know how they knew that the book was just about to close. I don't know how they knew what the title was. It certainly hadn't been published, but they did know both. And he said, look, Donald asked me to call. This is just a friendly call to tell you that you're going to wind up with egg on your face. You're going to be embarrassed. Your book is going to be obsolete by the time it hits the shelves. He's going to make a comeback. You got to get rid of that word downfall. And I said, tell Donald, as usual, he's been his insightful self. He found the only words in the book that I didn't write, and I will certainly get this message to Harper. The title was not my choice. So in any event, surprise, surprise, a week later, the publicist called back and said, well, did you change the title of the book? I mean, they seriously thought Harper was going to do that. Obviously, Donald is never going to be the Trump that we knew in the 80s. He's not going to have seven or eight balls in the air at the same time. He's not going to be doing like he did in 1 month in 1988, both the Taj deal and the shuttle. But he certainly is capable of doing another solid business deal. He may do the West Side Yards. He may do some part of the West Side Yards. He's always going to be a millionaire. His father's 85 or 86 and is worth certainly a few hundred million, so he's going to inherit something. So that we're going to see Donald Trump as a factor in our lives here in New York for a long time, but I don't ever think we're going to see the same kind of person that we saw who melded so well with an age.
Okay, Wayne Barrett, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
And Wayne Barrett is an investigative reporter for The Village Voice and author of the new book, Trump, The Deals and the Downfall, published by HarperCollins. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.